If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You already love the Mixing Music podcast, but what if I told you that there are over 250 exclusive episodes just waiting for you? That's right. On our Patreon, you get ad-free technical deep dives every single week on mixing, mastering, and production. If you want more knowledge, more techniques, and zero fluff, head to mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start leveling up your skills today. Welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me today we have a special guest. Welcome to the show, Michael J. Morgan.
Hey, hey. I like this intro.
Yeah.
Good energy.
Michael, there it is. Michael is specifically a notorious business coach for mixers specifically. I mean, he has coached and will coach other engineers. But specifically a business coach, mostly for mixers right now, based in LA. And you've worked and have coached and worked with awesome clients, some names, notably like John Castelli, Julia Borelli, and even Nathan Dantzler, who worked on some Sabrina Carpenter recently.
Yeah.
That's super cool for Nathan. Of course, John Castelli, that's super awesome. And a bunch of other friends that we have, mutual friends.
It was kind of hard to pick out the list. I mean, there's so many people we know and love.
Yeah, there is this, you've done something really cool and unique, if I may say so. It's like you've created this this inner circle type group, which I think is awesome for, you know, great leverage, but it's just like awesome that you can do that. And you seem to be a very gifted includer and connector of people. So I think it's just this really awesome thing that you're doing, which is funny too, because you could have been a business coach for anything. You know, it sounds like you came over before and we talked for a few hours before the recording of this episode. You have like a design background and graphic design and user experience and interfaces and stuff. So I have to ask before we start. How the heck did you get thrown into business coaching for mixers? That, like, the nicheness of that.
Yeah, it is. The niche is nearly microscopic. It's a long story, but ultimately, I've been designing for about 20 years. And the way I've really seen design has changed over the years to the point that, like, it is about caring for people at the end of the day. It's like, it is about, for design, it's almost manufacturing care, finding ways to better care and support people with products or services or websites or apps or whatever. So care has always been at the center of like my whole life, everything I've done, everything I'm interested in. And over the years, John Castelli and I have just been, I mean, he's one of my best friends. I've known him 20 years and I have seen his career grow and change. And, you know, whether it was assisting Tony Maserati or going out on his own or building a brand once he went out on his own, I've been like side by side with him, really helping him, you know, not in a management capacity, but in a really supportive capacity in terms of brand strategy, design, things like that. And so, when we started working together and we started seeing the effect, or I started seeing the effect that it could have on a mix engineer, then started meeting other mix engineers, I was like, you know, how could I kind of scale this out and work with more and more people and help them and care for them? And so there's been a ton of iterations of this thing, but I think the place I'm at right now feels really well aligned with me and beneficial to the people I'm helping, which is like this 12-week program, essentially, of just caring for them, understanding where they're at, helping them get through the process, the marketing, the branding side of things, and the mindset side of things. So, great. Yeah, it's been a long story, awesome. But that's the shortest I probably ever told it.
Well, today, this episode's going to be really awesome because one thing that we constantly talk about, me and Lude constantly talk about on the podcast, is obviously there's the art and craft of mixing. I would even, like, one of the things that I constantly talk about is like the philosophy behind creating art. But there's also one thing that I think we should do a better job talking about. I kind of got burnt out talking about it, but we should do more because it has had a great value in my career is the business side of this stuff. There's a form of, I brought it up before in a different episode, Michael, so I apologize for any listeners that are hearing me repeat this. There's a form of cognitive bias called the curse of knowledge, where once you understand something, you presume it's obvious to everyone. So it's like there's this thing where like the business stuff and the systems that I've created, like I keep forgetting that this isn't like an automatic no-brainer to most other people, which is my fault. It's my ignorance. And so what I've asked Michael to do is, as a professional educator of building systems, of strengthening the business side of every engineer's, you know, sole proprietorship, he's created a list of 14 things mix engineers need to know about business. All 14 of these things are incredibly applicable, practical, and definitely useful. The ROI from listening to this episode will probably be high. And I guarantee just by listening to this episode, your lifetime earnings will increase.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, let's get into this, dude. So number one, I'm going to read from this list that you wrote down here. Number one, your mixes aren't the problem. Your systems are. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this list was really fun to make. I think I made three iterations of it. I've really been trying to distill down, like, what do I see time after time working with over 300 people now and getting feedback from probably 500 or more people. All of these mix engineers are honestly really good at mixing, and that's not the problem. I think, like, when you start out in a career, you want to get good at mixing. That's sort of like your core directive. I need to be good at design. I need to be good at mixing, good at cutting hair, whatever it is. But there's a time where that sort of like caps and it's not really that important anymore. And other things become even more important. And I think what I'm seeing often and why I made this the first one is that like it's sort of at the center of this whole philosophy that I have, which is you need better systems in your business. Because your mixes are good enough. Honestly, even good enough is fine. But your systems are failing you, whether that's like the onboarding system you have or a sales system or your general, like even mixing process. These systems that really support the business, that make it a business that will last, are usually not there because the mixer is focused so much on being a mixer. And really, a lot of it has to do with identity, and we'll get into that kind of stuff later. But the idea of thinking you're a mixer makes you not think that you're anything else but that. And so all people tend to do is really fixate on getting good at mixing. And as a result, everything kind of like falls to the wayside.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's really interesting too. We're going to talk about some brief examples of specific systems. But just to be clear, for anybody listeners here, this is a book that I've recommended in the past. There's many revisions of this book, The E-Myth, Revisited by Michael Gerber. Great book about this, like the core thesis of the book is most businesses fail, not because of a lack of skill, but because of a lack of systems. Even James Clear, Atomic Habits. Atomic Habits is not like necessarily business centric. It's more like internal motivation and impulse control, conscientiousness oriented, like meta skill oriented. But it's like, I think he said, like, you do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. So for example, I think one thing that has helped me a lot is even a simple system of every day having a priority list or a to-do list of some kind. That is at the like essence of like a most basic level, some kind of a system, knowing what's on the plate, what I need to do, and what's prioritized for today. And I assume it gets much, much, much deeper than that, of course, Michael.
Yeah, and I think, well, a few things here. Love the e-myth. A fellow Michael wrote this book, so I always resonate when Michaels write books. I have a blog post actually called The E-Myth Revolution, What Every Mix Engineer Needs to Know About Building a Sustainable Career. It's like page two or three of my blogs, and it's literally taking the learnings from that and translating it to a mix engineer. So it's a fun read. I love that you mentioned that. It's one of my favorite books. Also, I was on Travis's podcast, Progressions. He mentioned Atomic Habits. I still have not read it. It's probably the 600th time this book has been mentioned. I think I need to read it at this point.
Well, the point is, it's not as like applicable specifically to mixing. It's more just like, how to set goals.
But here's the thing. I think, so something I've implemented in my 12-week coaching program is like a habit, kind of habit formation module where we are checking in on very specific habits every single week for 12 weeks. And they're also doing that every day. So there's like daily ones and weekly ones that we're checking in on. And it's probably like 10 things, I'd say. I don't want to give them all away, but I mean, you tapped into one of them, which is just like, what are the priorities here? And honestly, if you start there, if you get good at prioritizing, that is like a magic skill to be like, you know, I'm building software right now. We have 600 things we need to update. To know what the first one is like a painstaking effort and not one you should take lightly.
So real briefly, before we move on to the next step here, what is the difference between a mixer that has big, hairy, audacious goals and is really driven and like someone that has systems? Like there's a difference between someone that's just driven and then there's that undirected effort?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think, really great question. I think some people say that they want something more often than they actually really do want that thing. It's very easy for me to be like, I want to be a model or something, or I want to be an actor in LA or something. I don't want to be either of those things, but let's say I did. I'm doing nothing to get there. Like there's no effort to get there. And I think a lot of times, you know, people are like, yeah, dude, like I want to be in a band, like I want to go on tour and whatever, whatever. And like, but they're not playing shows. They're not putting out records. They're not, the last thing they're thinking about is making content. As soon as you ask them, would you make a TikTok? They're like, no way. I don't want to do that. So it's like, I think there's a difference between people that want a thing and people that are actively pursuing a thing. And then I think of the people that are pursuing a thing, that splits off into people that are sort of like haphazardly pursuing a thing, knocking into walls, knocking things over, like kind of blindfolded. And then there are people that are like, I need to keep things on the rails. I know that I need systems or I will be knocking things over. So let me get this together. And I'd say there's probably a third category that's like, because everything exists along a spectrum, there's like the hyper, hyper process-oriented people, which I am not. Like, I promise you that. And I actually don't recommend either one. Like, no system, I don't recommend. And like, hyper-systematized, I don't either. Because I think what that does is strip away all the humanity, assuming that like, you could just like completely architect your way to success. And the other thing is like, I'm just going to go based on vibe and like bang my way into success, banging on the walls, rolling around in mud. And eventually I'll get there. I think, I'm sure there are examples of both working. But I think like most things, there's a psychological principle of a pendulum swing where you kind of go from one end of a spectrum to another only to really find that center point. I think the center point is sort of where you reach like the real harmony of your career. So I think being a little bit scrappy and a little bit systematized is better than all in on one or the other.
For sure. I'm just imagining. I like the word putting humanity into things. I haven't said it that way, but I really like that wording of it. Because that's like what we do, especially as like service providers and of like not even just like the overly systematized like input output, but like custom service, white glove service for independently and individually created for each independent client. Like it's very human. It's extremely human. This design is very human. Sorry.
Totally, man. And that's where my design, you know, principles come in, right? It's like, you know, I've designed for so many different companies with such different needs and different offerings altogether. Like everything from like Home Depot to like someone that creates like, you know, clean energy, like little components, you know? And it's like, how do you translate that message? It can't be the same. And the same way with a career, it's like, you can't just like choose one way of doing it. You have to understand that like humans are complex. And as a result of that, you know, there isn't a one size fits all silver bullet thing. And again, it doesn't mean everything needs to be so custom that you're like losing money, making everything so custom for that person. I know people that are doing that and their business is suffering as a result. But it's also like, there needs to be humanity here. These are people. Their listeners are people. The artist is a person. You're a person, whether you want to believe it or not. You know, it's like, as much as you could automate your life, it's like you're still, we're all people here. And so there is an undeniable like connection we have, like our human antennas connect with humanity, or things that really have humanity at the center of it, rather than like a, let's add that on later. Like, oh, let's like scuff that up at the end to make it look human or something. You know, it's like when an AI company, like, you know, Claude or something has, you know, a serif font and it makes it look like all, you know, softer colors. And at the end of the day, it's an AI. Like, who are we kidding? You know? So, yeah, I don't know. That's my thought there.
It's awesome. There's a, sorry, I was thinking of a bit. There's a comedian that made a bit about AI and humanizing it. And he's like, most of the blogs on the internet, 60% of them are AI, according to Berkeley. And he goes and like, cites a bunch of these like huge Ivy League schools and like how many of the internet websites and blogs are AI. And then it turns out that all three of the sources he cited were made from AI and they're not real at all. Everybody is listening is like, what? It's just a dumb bit. All right. We're going to move on. We're going to move on to number two. Mindset can make or break your career.
Oh, I love this one so much. This is sort of something I uncovered through the practice of caring for people. I think when, to me, caring is really like starts with listening intently. What are they saying? What are they saying behind the thing they're saying? You know, if someone says like, yeah, today was good. Just based on how they said that, you can kind of tell that it probably wasn't entirely good and that there might be things that they want to expand upon. And so through hours, I mean, literal hundreds of hours, I think I hit 20,000 hours or 10,000 hours 2 years ago. I did the math because I'm a nerd like that. But through all of this time working with people, I realized that when you think about, this will get a little heady for a second, but when you think about a human and the, let's start over here. What is context, right? Psychologists want to know what context is. When you think about the word context, that really encapsulates everything a human goes through. So a lot of psychologists were trying to figure out what context is in an effort to help their patients do better in life. And so they created a model of context, which includes the individual and the goal that they have, right? These are two sides of a, if you're watching, this is on the left side is the person, the right side is the goal they want to achieve. And that person is in a situation, that's the place they're standing on right now. And that situation changes, right? Because time changes. And to get to that goal, there's a bridge. And on the way along that bridge, you could just fall off the bridge, right? And fall into this kind of pit of despair, you can call it. So they made this model of a very simple thing. It's kind of like Super Mario. It's just like, and you love Nintendo, so I think this will be a good one for you. Super Mario, he's on this path, trying to get that flag at the end of the level. Cool, we know he needs to do that, but you could fall into little pits along the way. And this is exactly how humans go about achieving goals. And so you have a human in a situation on a path to a goal. What helps them achieve a goal we could talk about, but it's essentially the word resources. Feel free to look into what resources really mean, the totality of what resources are. And the opposite of that, how do you fall off a cliff in a way? It's sort of these inverse resources that are not helping you. But one thing I noticed about this model that I wanted to update was sometimes people just don't start. Again, it's that example I mentioned before, the person that says they're on the path, but are they really? The reason I find people, and I was really curious about this, why are they like saying they're on this path, but they haven't really moved? Why are they almost moving away from the path, even though they're saying out loud that they're trying to pursue this thing? It really had me all mixed up. And after a while, I realized that what they were telling themselves about themselves, about their situation, their context, was defining what they were doing after. And what they have been doing in the past, it was redefining their past. It was defining their future. It was defining who they are. And usually it was negative. usually, whether it was completely negative or 80% negative, there was negativity built in. And even with the most positive person, there are still negative narratives that people carry. And so I realized that the mindset, the way your mind is set, is determining what happens next. And that's why I say it can make or break your career, because the stories that you tell yourself are going to dictate what actions you take. And I really make an effort with my clients to, one, identify the litany of those narratives. I mean, I'm talking like I have a list of probably 200 positive and negative narratives one could carry. And people add new ones every day. They surprise me. But I have them go through that list and really circle each one. And then as we're talking, I identify new, really nuanced ones that are unique to them. And what we do is systematically reshape those as we go through the program, because we all carry them, myself included. And that is going to determine, you know, if I feel like I'm an idiot or I'm incapable or I, you know, can't accept help from people or I can't trust people, let's say, how am I going to go about my day? How am I going to go on this podcast, going into it saying I don't trust people, and then trust that you be cool, you know, be, you know, like not like, you know, undermine me or something, right? But if I go in being like, I can't trust anyone, now I'm scared, I'm rigid, the whole podcast changes, right? So it's really important to identify the narratives you're carrying, but also to rewrite them when they are steering negative, and really enhance the ones that are positive, put those to the forefront, because that is really the fuel that you're going to have. It's the only thing we have at all times is our brain. So if these stories are looping around in there, you can't argue that. I mean, I will go on record and debate anyone that's going to argue that their mindset has no effect on their career. I think it's impossible.
This episode is brought to you by AeroPress. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I'm a big coffee nerd, and I care about the roast levels, source regions, and elevations of my beans, etc., and do everything I can to enjoy my cup of bean juice to jumpstart my workday. It's more than caffeine consumption. It's a morning ritual that marks my readiness to take on the creative work I've planned as a mixer. When I'm not using my espresso machine, I prefer to make my coffee with AeroPress. If you haven't heard of AeroPress, it's a manual coffee maker, kind of like a French press, but way better. It uses a unique brew method that gives you smoother, richer, and less bitter cups of coffee. Every cup I've ever made with an AeroPress has remarkably smooth flavors. It only takes 2 minutes to brew a cup of coffee, and it's also incredibly portable and easy to clean. Whenever I'm traveling, going camping, or even just making a cup for myself or friends, AeroPress is the way to go. I don't want to sound overly effusive here, and I'm being genuine. I'm trying to be as genuine as I can, but to show evidence of how much coffee nerds love the AeroPress, fans of the AeroPress actually host an annual world recipe competition. You can YouTube this stuff. It is every coffee nerd's dream. If you've been thinking about getting a better cup of coffee or becoming a coffee nerd yourself, AeroPress is definitely the most accessible way to brew incredible cups of coffee. AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer for our audience. Visit aeropress.com/MMPOD. That's AEROPRESS.com/MMPOD, and use the code MMPOD to save 20% off your order. That's aeropress.com/MMPOD. Be sure to use the code MMPOD at checkout to save 20%. It's time to ditch the drive-thru, toss the French press, and say yes to better mornings fueled by better coffee. AeroPress ships to the USA and over 70 countries around the world, and we thank AeroPress for sponsoring the show.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I am a big big time fan of this. So a couple things I want to address before I rant on this, because I am on your team on this.
We're
piggybacking on you. Is a couple things. One danger is that for whatever reason, especially within the field of politics, people love to weaponize this mindset. And that is, of course, something that we will not address. Like, for example, it's like if it becomes into like identity politics, and then it's like, well, all you have to do is just make better decisions. That's why you're poor. And it's like, all right, it's sometimes it's more than that. There's probably, but like weaponizing that is the part that's not good. So that's the first thing that I want to say, which is a great counter argument to the belief that we both have that I'm about to jump on. But other than that, like realistically speaking, again, something that is can't like, let me put my thoughts together. Sorry. You are very articulate and I'm trying to calm down and be the same here. A book that I love, that I've always recommended, what was it called?
Go get it.
Yeah, I'm about to go get it.
We can do anything we want here.
Duh. Of course. Duh. I can't believe I forgot it. I read this a couple times. I love it so much. It's called The Courage to be Disliked. It's a very easy read about the psychology and the philosophy of Alfred Adler. I've brought this up many times on previous episodes of the podcast. And he talks about teleological context or causation versus ontological context or causation. Teleological meaning that we have goals. And in order to reach those goals, we have something that we want to achieve, and then we use past experiences to achieve those goals. So for example, if you're really shitty to a customer service worker, like a Starbucks employee, like one way, an ontological way of looking at that or deriving context is, my parents were mean to me, and so that's why I'm mad and socially anxious, and that's why I'm going to be mean to this person. But the teleological, and again, the dangerous part of believing this is people weaponizing this. This is, has to be personified within yourself. This is the only way to look at this. It's like, you can't tell other people to stop. Like, you need to, you're in control of your own action. It's more like, I'm in control of my own actions, right? It's an individual thing. He's like, for example, then it becomes, I have a goal of, the teleological explanation is, I have a goal of being mean. And so I'm going to use my frustration and past experiences to excuse my bad behavior. And again, if you look at it in the right context for yourself and not for the sake of others, it's really freaking empowering. I mean, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning that's like a big thesis of the book. It's like the stories you tell yourself and that you're empowered to do so in the face of something like horrible, right? And this is like really hated on, like one of my favorite studies that I always, again, this is like a really can be taken out of context study, so I want to be careful. But like the famous study of the 1980s, psychologist Robert Kleck, the Dartmouth Scar Experiment, where they basically took a bunch of people in the room, put a makeup scar on their face, like a visible scar, and then they said they're going to touch it up, and they took off the scar, actually, and then they basically had people mingle, and more people, if they thought they had a scar on their face, a visible scar on their face, they took everyone's experiences very negatively. So it's like this self-narration and like self, like the narratives that they held within themselves, the insecurities that they had reflected on how they felt about the conversations that they had with people and how they felt about the interactions they had. And so they projected all these feelings based off of like, it's just a scar thing. And it's so fascinating. You talked about narratives. I really liked what you said about listening behind the thing that they're saying, especially with some of these artists and producers where they're so creative, they have a hard time articulating what they're trying to really say, or they don't have the tools or the words to say it. And like half of our jobs is to be like, what are you really trying to say? And like then fighting against their insecurities and the narratives that they've built up, and even within ourselves, fighting against our own thing. I have to sing your praises. One of the things that I heard my buddy James, who has been through your course, You said this, so I'm gonna bring it up. You said that you systematically address the narratives and insecurities that people have with the people that you coach. And like addressing insecurities and where you have unaware need for validation, especially as a creative mixer, like, oh my gosh, I don't know how. It's so simple and it's kind of obvious, but I don't think people realize how genius this is and how important it is to have a third party person go through this with you. Like, one of the problems of the human mind is you can't see this stuff for yourself, really, no matter how intelligent you are. So when I heard you said this, and then I remember James saying that he did this too, I was like, that is incredibly genius. It might be worth it on its own. Sorry.
Sometimes I think after like week 4 or 3, depending on how long we go into the mindset work, I think we're done here. You know, like just keep doing this. You know, obviously we always do 12 weeks, but I think there is so much value in it. The transformation I've seen grown men cry who I don't think have ever cried in front of anyone or themselves even in recent years. I've seen people realize some really deep trauma that they have that they were like, oh, I didn't realize like that's probably why I've been doing that thing. You know, very recently, just a beautiful unlock in a session where a client didn't do an assignment for 2 weeks in a row. And I said, hey, like, we need to talk about this. Because if you think about it from my perspective, I need to call this stuff out. Like, that's not always the most fun. Or, you know, that's not the thing everyone wants to do. But to say, hey, I'm noticing a pattern here. And I think we should look at that. Because actually, I think that's the assignment, really, is uncovering for both of us why the assignment wasn't done. Because there's something there. There's a narrative that led you to not doing it. There's insecurity. And it was amazing because what we got to was, I am afraid to ask for help. And that's what the person said. But I've also said that. And it really resonated with me in that session because I said, hey, man, it's totally fine. I could take this camera off the hinges and show you a post-it note. Actually, I'll just take the post-it note off, which is a post-it note I have on my screen at all times, which is accept help. And
yeah,
I look at this every day, and my one of my best friends, Ebony Oshino, who you got to meet recently, he called me yesterday and we were talking about a situation he was in, and he's like, dude, I thought about that post-it note in the situation. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to accept help. I think it's such an important thing. It's very meta to what I do because I am help for people and for them to even accept, the fact that they might need someone to look at their stuff is big. But the idea of like accepting help from anyone, whether it's family or friends, whether it's financial, whether it's informational, whether it's like, hey, can you like help me move today? All of these things are help. And I went through a major surgery recently and I had to ask my friends to take care of me. And it was actually hard for me. And that's why I have this post-it note on my screen, because it was like, I'm just as flawed as anyone else. You know, I'm not saying, oh, I coach you, so therefore I'm perfect and you're completely flawed and let me impart all my wisdom. I am like, I promise you, I'll get my therapist on here. He'll promise you as well that I'm just as flawed. And one of those ways out of carrying that flaw, to the example you mentioned, carrying the scar, feeling like the scar is still on you, is being relentless in the pursuit of rewriting the narratives that we carry. And part of that to me is that, or I guess the narrative could be something like, I can't accept help, or I can't trust other people, or no one does care about me, or really all of those things I've carried over the years. So having accept help in front of me to look at daily, literally daily, I mean, we're talking probably 15 times a day, at least that I remember. And then subconsciously, I'm seeing it all the time. Doing things as simple as that are really, really important because yes, I can go into a room or in a situation where I need help and all of a sudden I forget to accept it, right? Or I, you know, those old narratives come back. I go, I can't trust anyone here. I can't ask them for anything. And just, I mean, this is one of many post-it notes, one of many narratives that I need to rewrite and I am continuing to. It's not a one and done thing. And I think to your point about weaponizing mindset, things get weaponized when they're packaged in the form of silver bullets. It's like, oh, you just need to wake up tomorrow and say that you're able to accept help and then everything's good. And that's not taking into account the journey and the struggle and the biology and the sociology and every sort of context that that person is in. Because if every day I'm in a relationship where someone's like, I refuse to help you and you suck and you're the worst, it's going to be much harder for that person versus someone that's like, you know, in a family of super supportive people that are like, anytime you need help, give us a call. You know what I mean? So to say that it's just like the same for everyone is so horrible. And I think that's the weaponizing part. The other side of the weaponizing is just the like, if you think this way, you're a good person. If you think that way, you're a bad person. Because thoughts are just the beginning of all of it. Actions are really what reflects the person at the end of the day. And I mean, there's just so much to it. And to even just have a thought and have a really fixed thought, that takes a lot of curation and repetition. I know it because I'm trying to help people rewrite thoughts. So, you know, it's dangerous to think that your thoughts could be rewritten immediately. And it's also really dangerous to just subscribe to thoughts of other people haphazardly, including myself. And there's another rule here. I guess if we could skip to a rule, I think one of the 12 things mixed engineers need to know about business, there's one here about most famous engineers were lucky, stop copying them. There's sort of these anomaly mixed engineers that like we, well, I'm not saying every mixed engineer was lucky and that's the only way, you know, that they got successful. But part of it, part of why I wrote this one was about them being really unable to translate everything it took to get there. And so we see this sort of summation of people, and then we just assume if I act like the summation of that person, I'll get to where they are. But they're doing a bad job at extracting all of the steps, the relationships, the systems, the mindset that they carried to get to a place. So that's why I say stop copying them, because stop copying the summation of a person. Why does that have to do with mindset? Because it's really hard to distill mindset from someone just talking about their career in an interview or something. You notice it more on the day-to-day with that person. And if you don't have the opportunity to spend time with famous engineers every day, all you're going to do is summarize. So rather than worry about that, tap into your own mindset, build your own luck, preparedness meeting opportunity, and so refine your mindset.
I need to say that we're 30 minutes in, and we're on number two, going on to number three. So I'm going to shut up, okay? This is a problem that I have. I'm going to shut up so we can get through this list, because this list is incredible. The reason why I love this is when it comes to mindset, some people immediately think, oh, I need to David Goggins and bootstrap this, you know, get a hold of myself. And there's a time and a place for that. Like sometimes you're anxious, sometimes you're nervous, sometimes you have to do things anxious and nervous, right?
Yes.
But there's a bigger thing that you're talking about here. And we can talk about the Zen philosophy of alignment and whatnot, which goes exactly into what you're talking about. But I think people have a problem with accepting not just help, but like of anything. Like they prevent themselves the things that they should have received. Like a good gig, a good client, right? A possible a bigger invoice. Like, I think those are internal narratives and internal things that people stop themselves from trying to go for. And that's the mindset we're trying to clear. Like, the last time I got upset at a revision note was probably because I had some sort of narrative or insecurity deeply tied to that. And once you clear that, you become a better service worker. Imagine that. A better service provider, sorry.
Right. Or caregiver.
Caregiver.
Let's refine service. Because service almost feels like you're just like a slave to the, you know, person paying you. And really, it's like you're a caregiver, a caretaker, or you're both. And you should take care of that person. And if you're thinking, they don't like it, like I suck, like I'm the worst designer ever, I'm the worst coach ever because someone had a bit of feedback, you're just going to crumble. And then you're not going to be able to care for them or see the opportunity to care.
Right. Oh man, that's so awesome. I like that. Caregiver over service provider. I'm going to shut up now. I'm going to let you go through number three. Stop selling hours start selling transformations.
Yeah, I think this is directly aligned with the caregiver mentality. It's like a lot of people hop on the phone. A lot of people do not even hop on the phone with an artist. They get a DM, they send them rates. The guy says, or gal says, yes or no. And that's it. And that's the end of the relationship. Then they get sent files. If they say yes, they do those files. Maybe they get notes. Maybe they crumble when they get bad feedback. Eventually, this thing gets delivered and it's done. And that is the least human process. We're talking about humanity. That is like the least human process. And one that I would question, did you really get into this career to do that? Like to be this like sort of factory line, like automated service where you drop a Dropbox link into a DM and get a mix back? I mean, like I could just automate that with AI. I mean, there's plenty that does that. You know, I think where this one comes from is the idea that like you're working with artists, and I always question how well does the mix engineer understand the life of an artist? The day-to-day, the needs, the wants, the dreams, the hopes of an artist. Because if you were to care for that person, if that is your job, and we're agreeing to that, you and I are anyway, but if other people are listening, agree to the caretaker mentality, then how well do you know about the person you're taking care of? If you were working at a nursing home and you were with like a 97-year-old person who, you know, is bedridden, you're not going to be like, you got to run right now. That's the way you're going to get healthy. You know, it's like, you clearly don't understand this person you're caring for. And so I would love to quiz every single mix engineer on how well do you know this artist's vision? What is their goal? Who are their biggest influences? Why does this song mean anything to them? Or the producer who worked on it? Like, have you even spoken to them? And the answer I know is usually no to all of those things. Like, I don't know. I just got a file, Dropbox/whatever, and I'm just sending a file back, you know, Dropbox/whatever. And that is our interaction. And so how do you sell transformation? Well, you're transforming a song. That is the goal of it. Now, this could be a 5% transformation, a 1%, or a 100% transformation, depending on the state of the song and really what the artist is looking for. But you can only determine how much transformation is needed by really understanding that art. And so I think that the art and the artist. And so at the end of the day, clients aren't buying your time. They really are not. They're buying so many other things from you, which include your ability to care, your understanding, your confidence, your ability, your momentum, even your network and your accolades. They're buying that as well. And so, you know, I think someone might come back and say, no, they're not. They've never said that. And there's, you know, the classic sort of design quote about building something for somebody, not based on what they tell you, is Henry Ford saying, if I asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. They never would have said a car. And so it's like, how much are you just relying on someone like giving you the most overt feedback about what they need, assuming they're so well aware of what they need that they're literally going to be like, I'm so aware of exactly what I need. Here is everything. I'm going to poke you until you realize it, read through this list of things that I need and do it. No, that's part of the caretaker, is to see beyond what they're saying and provide that to them in the way that they need it, in the way that they feel confident. And sometimes that's like knowing their favorite snack or making the studio like a little bit nicer so that they feel more comfortable, or meeting them in a certain place before you even start working, or all of the above and many more things. I know people listening will be like, all right, I'm going to do those three things and that'll be it. It's a infinite array of things. It never ends if you really get into the mindset of caring for someone. So you're selling all of that. You're not selling a WAV file or an MP3 or stems. You're selling all of that. And if the artist feels that way, I can promise you the odds of them coming back are like almost undeniable, given, you know, some variability of labels deciding to work with you again or not.
I have a question for you before we go into the next one here.
Yeah.
What are some ways to generate or to align with the client to care? For example, I assume one way is to charge more. That'll get you to care. or to be more selective with your clients? Like, what are some more practical and ways that you've seen to better align to care?
I think the root of care is listening. And then I think post-listening comes discernment. And so I could listen to you and you could be like, yeah, man, I want to give you a dollar for your 12-week coaching program. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, it doesn't seem like this person values what I do. And that's okay. I also say, yeah, man, sure. Like, I'm so excited to sell you this course. Like, whatever, like, what do you want? You know, like, and then day into it, the second you ask me the first question, I go, I'm resenting this person and it's his fault. But it's not. You know, so part of it is you have to listen to what that person needs, what they value, what they're after, and decide whether or not that aligns with you. And you might say, well, I need the work. And I will say, okay, sometimes you're going to have to take the L on that and work with someone. Maybe the values don't align. It's not always going to. Or there's on the opposite end of that, rearrange your living situation where you can say no more than being forced to say yes. That is always what I recommend. And I'm living proof of that. But listen, be in the place where you can be calm enough to listen, stable enough to listen, confident, certain enough to listen to the person, what they need. Get really good at asking questions. That, like, and this is something I do with my clients. I literally role play with them multiple days where we're having conversations. And all of a sudden, I'm the artist or I'm the manager, or I'm whoever. And they're speaking to me and I'm evaluating them. And a lot of them are just struggling to even ask questions. They want to talk about themselves. They want to talk about how cool their studio is or the monitors they just got or the cool project they were done. And I don't care. I'm the artist. I don't even know what the hell that is. You know, like I don't care about the panels in your room unless it makes my record 100 times better. You know, and you know what I'm talking about because we've done it. We've all done it. Like it's, you know, so listening, I think, is the root of care. And then responding is part B. And responding can be, this person is not for me, right? I had to do this yesterday. Someone asked for a very unique version of my program that I don't have the capacity, the time, the infrastructure to support or want to support. It was also for a lower rate. And so I had to say, like, what can I do? And it's like, here, what about this offering? This seems like the closest thing, but this is something I'm comfortable doing, right? I could have also accepted the work and been resentful the entire time. And that only reflects me now because that person could go into the world and say, well, he agreed to this and now, you know, I didn't get a good result and it is my fault. So you have to listen and then decide. And in the decision, it might be a hard decision to turn down $2,000 on a Tuesday. And it was, but that's ultimately what I did. I've turned down $10,000 some days, like straight up. I think one day I turned down $30,000 in a day, which most people listening would be like, what the hell are you doing? You must be like super rich and that's why. Like, no, I turned it down so I'd have so much free time to invest in building this program, to invest in building software that I'm building. I go, I just don't have the time to do it. And it was devastating. It was the worst day because I'm like, that's gonna leave a mark in the bank account. But I knew it will come back. There will be another opportunity. And the opportunity will be one that I want to say yes to. Because there is nothing worse than saying yes to a thing that you don't want to do and you drag your heels. So again, deciding after that is very unique to you, but you have to. So you have to listen well and then decide how. That's saying no, but when you're saying yes, decide how you're saying yes in detail and make that agreement a real agreement.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I may, I want to combine this with number five, which we'll go over briefly later.
Yeah.
80% of the work comes from relationships, not ads, which is like very similar to this idea. If I were to be a little bit more selfish and Machiavellian in perspective here, like all I have to do as a psychopath is get them to trust me. If I can get them to trust me or feel like they trust me, and I can do that through manipulative form, then That would work, unfortunately, right? But more, I really like what your personal advice here, because I was thinking about, okay, what is the thing, that the practical thing that we need to do? Do we need to say no more often? Do we need to do this more often? What is it we do? You said, because there's two sides to care. There's the side of the artist feeling cared for, and then there's the side of the provider that wants to care for the project that they're working on. And how do you develop care on both sides? You said listening. And I cannot think of a better answer at the more of the root cause, the root of the issue, the root of the thing right there is listening. I love that. Every time I've listened to an artist and heard about what they're going for, it's just like, there's something human in me that's just like, yeah, hell yeah. And I get excited about it. But, and then in turn, they as well as the one that's receiving the care also feels cared for. Right. So I think it's just awesome.
And you know, anyway, you saying that, the listening part, when I said, you know, it's listening then responding, really the responding is listening to yourself. It's like listening to them and then listening to yourself. Is this the right project? Is this money the right amount? Will I feel good? Like, it's asking yourself questions too and being honest. Because we often are just like, I'm so excited about this artist. They're so cool and like they're gonna blow up and da 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 da. And they're paying me nothing and it's going to take, you know, 15 days of work and I'm going to need to travel for it. And I'm going to need to turn down these 5 paid gigs, but I'm going to take it. And it's like, well, did you ask yourself those questions? Because if you did, I don't think you would have said yes. You know, yeah. So it's like listening to yourself is really important and instinctually you'll know right away. So listening, that's it.
Love it. Love it. Number 4, know your numbers.
Know your numbers. This is a great one. So for my own business, I have in Notion a dashboard of how many of each tier we have to sell. There's technically 8 tiers, 6 tiers that we sell. And there is a certain number per month I want to hit to allow for the lifestyle that I want to live. And that's the key word, because the lifestyle I've lived has varied. I have a pretty nice apartment now. In the past, I've lived literally with holes in the walls, leaks in the walls, because I was trying to save up enough money and build enough clientele to eventually change my lifestyle. So if you don't know your numbers, you're not going to know where you're at. There's no orientation to where you are. So it's hard to know where you can go. And it's also, I think the reason people don't know their numbers is because it's painful. And I do this every week with clients, I go, how many calls did you make this week? And they go, 0. How many new clients do you have? 0. How much money did you make this week? I think it was like $100. And I feel the pain that they have. I feel pain for them. I feel their pain. But there's something that happens in that moment when they're saying it, when they have to say 0, when they have to say $100 and they really wanted to say $5,000 or $1,000,000. You know, saying the number out loud, facing that beast in your head that's the scary thing to face, is really empowering after, because it's like, I just go, all good. It's 0, 1,000, I don't care, all good. All of it's learning. All of it is going to get us closer to growing that number. Because if it's 000 and then 1 week it's 5, the first question I'm going to ask is why? What happened? How do we get to 5? And there's a learning there. But if you just go 0000, you're actually not keeping track. You get to the end of the year, you go, I had 50 clients. And I go, why? And you're like, I don't know. Well, when did you get them? I don't know. How many calls did it take him? I don't know. There's nothing being tracked. And so there's no way of knowing how to do it again. Like, because if I go, all right, well, next year, let's do 51. Let's use all the techniques you used and apply it. That, well, they'd go, I didn't really use any techniques. I just sat around. It's like, well, that next year you might sit around and only get 30. So that's not enough. There's a reason you got 50, whether or not you are tracking it and aware of it. So let's be aware of it. Why not? And let's hold ourselves accountable, because at the end of the year, if you made 30,000 or 100,000 or 0, whether you knew you made that or didn't know you make that actually makes a big difference. Even if you made the same amount each year, if you made 30K and knew about it versus not, that allows you to decide what's next and not live in this sort of abyss and with lack of clarity.
Which is the problem of every sole proprietor, entrepreneur, 1099.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, dude, I love that. In fact, while you were talking, I kind of reflected on my numbers. Interesting. Okay, we talked about number five. Let's briefly talk about it. 80% of work comes from relationships, not ads. Anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I would say that there are a lot of coaching programs, which I will not name, that are very ad-centric, that are like, we just need to make ads and here's how you can do that. And I offer YouTube playlists to anyone that's considering working with any program that is just pushing ads on them. And these are YouTube playlists of like a 25-year-old kid who shows you how to set up meta ads. It's very easy. I don't recommend it as your core strategy. And honestly, probably for most people with the goal of like being this like massive, well-known mix engineer as the strategy. I think what this does is make the people, like, remember I talked about the spectrum of like humanity to like systemizing. It makes the people that are already robotic and systematized be like, sick. All I need to do is talk to even less people. I can just like talk to this meta ad AI and it'll run ads and then I'll get work and I still won't have to talk to them. Like, this is perfect for me. And I just don't want to encourage bad behavior in the work that I do. And it's like the long tail of that behavior is even less and less humanity, more commoditization of the art and the craft, and just like more sterility, is that a word? Just more sterile work. I think why I say 80%, and I would even argue more, higher, 95% of work comes from relationships, is that the work with meaning, with richness, with understanding of who you are, with a connection to your world, whether you came up in like the punk rock world or, you know, that's where I did, so I'll use that example, or K-pop or some, whatever, like you're more likely, if you live in that world and you want to contribute back into that world, you're going to get that from relationships that are tried and true. Also, it's just great practice to continue to hone that human instinct, that human touch, that human necessity in the work, in every stage of the work. This is like the getting work stage, you need humanity. In the doing work stage, you need humanity. In the finishing work, you need humanity. Like, so to just like automate this and automate that and automate that, it's cool. You can do things faster and you absolutely should automate certain things. But like, to replace building relationships with ads, to me, is a very dangerous path, truly.
Yeah. I wanted to add a little something, but I forgot what I was going to add. So we're going to move on to the next
It'll
part here.
Back.
This is something that I have self-admittedly, I have admitted on the podcast multiple times. Brief story of this podcast. I was part of a podcast marketing firm as a startup, and this podcast was an experiment of testing the Apple Podcast and Spotify algorithms and doing a few different experiments with. So the podcast was a means to an end of exploring and then eventually, you know, getting the most out of the algorithm, algorithm hacking. What I didn't think about was this. Because if I did the podcast for the purpose of getting more clients, I would have had a totally different strategy. Number six is content should attract artists, not other engineers.
Dude, you're such a good host, man. I love this. That lead-in was beautiful. I'm like imagining I'm on like a famous TV show or something. The transitions are perfect. Anyway, that's a side note. I just want to give you some flowers here, but that was incredible. Okay, so content should attract artists, not other engineers. Like everyone, there's like two things people come to me and ask for. how do I get clients? And can you help me with social media? And I just laugh because every time I'm like, this is like the complete wrong prompt. Like, this is why you're in the situation you're in most likely. But like, that question is not the path towards achieving greatness. And a lot of times people are trying to figure out, well, how do I make content? And so they're going to go to, if I'm a mix engineer, they're going to go to my page. They're going to look at it. They're going to say, well, he posts about like his gear and he posts the studio photos and he posts, about horseback riding. So I'm going to do that. That's obviously what's cool. And that's what people do. And that's what this one person did. So I'm just going to model my whole life on that. And that's what I mentioned earlier about like, don't copy other people's careers, like make your own career, because you don't know what they're doing behind the scenes, first of all, to attract people. And second of all, like just copying another person, this community is pretty tight knit. And I feel like people know when you're like kind of biting off someone else's game. So uniqueness is a value of the artist. It's very meta, but it's like how you're demonstrating the content that you put out is also like the type of it. The uniqueness is a value of the artist. They want to be unique. They're going to find an affinity to people who are unique. And so if you're putting out content that is unique, that is grabbing them in an interesting way that feels artful and thoughtful, that communicates the needs of the artist, that maybe can help artists with things, could be educational, could be entertaining for artists, whatever it is, you're going to find more resonance with artists. It doesn't matter. Like I had a client that struggled to get clients, blamed me, but on their CRM was other mix engineers. That was it. It was just like 15 other mix engineers. And I was shocked. And I'm like, well, what do we do here?
You know, like, trying to sell to your peers? Like what?
Yeah. I'm like, are you selling like plugins? Are you selling hardware? Cause that will work. Like if you're a hardware company, you should have a CRM of mix engineers, or a CRM for those that don't know, just a way of tracking your customers, like kind of organizing them so you, that you're aware of what they're doing and kind of being reminded to reach out, et cetera. So yes, if there's 15 mix engineers you want to reach out to, I hope you're selling a product that isn't mixing because they're not going to buy it unless they're looking for an assistant, in which case that's a totally different business. I would not want to make a business of being an assistant. I want to make a business where I get out of being an assistant as soon as possible. So, you know, your list of clients and the way you create content, again, it's care for them. If it's just about you completely, there's no value there. And so there's no resonance there. And then eventually you get muted or unfollowed or you don't even get followed in the first place. You know, and that's just the facts. I mean, that's the reality. I've been muted, unfollowed. I check my unfollow metrics. I love it. I'm like, cool. We're filtering people out. This is great. You know, like, but if you're consciously aware of it, you know, like people that follow me from high school, I don't want them to follow me anymore. There isn't, they wouldn't enjoy what I'm posting. I get it. That's totally fine. You know, but if artists are unfollowing you and you're a mix engineer, there's an issue there. And if mixers are following you and you're a mix engineer, there's an issue there. You know, like, and you know, if there's a blend of it, cool. But if it's primarily mix engineers that you're speaking to, you're tapped into something, but that something is not the thing you claim to want.
Right. So if I may be more specific, like if the goal... Like you need to know the goal. It's, you've already expressed this, right? Like, is this to build respect and notoriety for my name, or is this to find clients? And if it's to find clients, you should make content or do everything for potential clients, right? And that's
that
like
finds
them. Yeah. Like this even goes like practically. We joked about this when you came over the other day. I was like, I had a buddy that was looking for a girlfriend. He was looking for a girlfriend. He's like, I'm struggling. I'm not finding the right woman. He's complaining about this. Like classic male complaints about finding this woman. And I asked him straight up, all right, like who's your avatar? Which is like the marketing business term for like ideal client. Like what is, like let's be specific here. Is this like a Catholic Latina that went to college that wants to have, like be as specific as possible as like your avatar, your ideal woman. And I had him describe his ideal woman. And then I was like, straight up, do you think you're going to find this woman at the club? Because that's what you're doing. You're going to the club and you're looking for an intelligent church-going woman. Dude, you're not going to find her. Go to the freaking library. Go to church. Like, whatever. Like, go anywhere else just to increase your chances of finding. And that's like, that's the thing, right? Like go to, like, first off, so like, go into the concept of like, who's your ideal client and being clear about that. And then target that client. I'm not selling mixing to other mix engineers. Like, I'm not selling to my peers. And that was, again, the number one mistake. If I were to do this podcast over again, I'd probably do like a songwriting podcast, or maybe even like, still could, I'm not going to. But one of the reasons why Lou changed his career path and started marketing as a mastering engineer was because I wanted to experiment through him how much more work he got if, as like a mixing podcast, if he was mastering engineer, which is part of a, not Pure Mix, but there's a big channel on YouTube that I'm forgetting who the host is a mastering engineer, and most of his videos are mixing and producing. Almost all of his videos are mixing and producing, which is exactly what we're talking about here, right? So
this is the Australian dude?
Not the Australian dude.
Well, I got to give him a shout out because he shouted me out on two of his podcasts.
Not Panorama. I'm talking, I need to look it up. But he's the big one that used to host like MixCon. If I remember. Anyway, I apologize. So I'm so sorry. But anyway, yeah, if I were to do this podcast over again for the intention of finding clients, I would have not done a mixing podcast. But at the same time, on the opposite hand, I've gotten a lot of other benefit, more PR-oriented benefit from the podcast, which is partially why, like, I get, you know, I get more free plugins, you know? So that, that alone, I guess, makes it kind of worth it. And honestly, maybe it's an ego thing. I just like to feel like I have something, like, I like to teach, you know? Be in a position to teach, whatever it is. But yeah, that's the biggest mistake for sure with this podcast. Hey, what up? This is DK here to tell you that this is the end of part one of this two-part episode with Michael. We talked for just over 2 hours, and I'm not Joe Rogan, so I'm not going to put out a two-hour-long podcast. That's just what it is. An hour is long enough, but the second half is just as interesting, if not more interesting, as we dive deeper into some of the principles that we talked about and how to practically implement some of these ideas into our business.
But lastly, you can go to Michael's website. It's super simple. MJM.earth. MJM.earth. And he's got a special discount for anybody that's listening. If you go through all the different offerings, he's got some free offerings. He's got some like PDF type easy offerings, just some like blueprints. He calls it the blueprint. Obviously the courses, the solo courses and coaching. And then there's also different types of group coaching. It's whatever. There's something that he's got called the Accelerator Bundle, which is basically his paid for blueprint along with a 90-minute phone call, like a private one-on-one phone call to kind of talk about systems, how to raise rates with confidence and grow sustainably. You know what he's done? If you go to his website, mjm.earth, go to the Accelerator Bundle specifically and type in the code MMPOD, he will take off the discount and basically give you the blueprint for free. So you're only paying for the call, and which is extremely kind of him. And on that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're serious about getting better at mixing and producing, this is for you. Our Patreon gives you access to weekly ad-free technical episodes, plus a library of over 250 past episodes packed with mixing, mastering, and production knowledge you won't find anywhere else. Don't miss out. Join now at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive and start learning today.